Let's talk to a guy who gets to do this for a living.
Loose puck far side. Tierney, protected. Giving to Donskoy behind the nets. Turning, shooting, star! Jonas Donskoy! 7:42 left to go in overtime. And the kid from Finland snaps one past Murray to give the Sharks life in the Stanley Cup final. The Sharks win 3-2, and Donskoy is the man who does it.
And that gentleman is a native of Milford, right around the corner here, and he is the 2023 named winner of the Foster Hewitt Memorial Award, awarded by the Hockey Hall of Fame to a broadcaster who was cited as doing great work for years and years and years for the NHL and hockey in general. Great to talk with Dan Ruzanowski again. Dan, my old friend, how are you? It's been too long. How have you been?
Boy, it sure has been too long. And on WICC, of all stations, my gosh, I mean, if you want to talk P1s, I grew up listening to that station when Al Warren was doing Mooring. So I go back a long way.
Yeah, Dan, congratulations. This is great. Now, a lot of folks may remember your name, although they may not listen to Sharks broadcasts, you know, you being on the other coast now. But they remember your days, Dan, when you and I used to populate the old New Haven Coliseum and the Nighthawks games. And Dan, those are great years. I still have a couple of Nighthawks T-shirts that I wear, and invariably I'll get a thumbs up or a blow of a horn as somebody drives by. Talk about those early days with you coming from Milford, doing college hockey, and then hooking on with the Nighthawks.
Well, of course, this was in the 1980s, and I had just gotten out of college, and I was still broadcasting college hockey at St. Lawrence. And, of course, if those of you who are tuned into either Sacred Heart or Quinnipiac, you're going to find St. Lawrence occasionally on the schedule, certainly Quinnipiac every single year. But I had the opportunity to come into New Haven when the position opened up, and it was a great chance to learn about the business. Roy Malacher, of course, who became the president of a couple of NHL franchises, was running things back then when I got started, and learned a lot from him and from everybody in that office. And I've got so many fond memories of going down to the Coliseum and being part of, I think, one of the great AHL traditions that there is, and that is hockey in New Haven. I know that the Coliseum's not there anymore. The old New Haven Arena is long gone, too, but I do believe that the tradition of professional hockey in New Haven, especially at the AHL level for the 20 years that the Nighthawks were there, are something for the entire region to be really proud of. And, of course, it carries on a little bit with the Bridgeport Islanders, but, you know, obviously a different city and a different set of circumstances. But, you know, you go back to the early days in New Haven when Murray Murdoch was coaching Yale University and when Lynn Patrick, Craig Patrick's father, was coaching the New Haven Ramblers of the AHL back in the 40s. And they were the guys who put together Pee Wee hockey, that is youth hockey in the United States. So there's a lot of great history in that city. And of course, in the years that I was there, the 5 years from 1986 to 1991, we had some amazing moments. We had a trip to the Calder Cup final back in 1989, the opening of the jungle in section 14 of the Coliseum. It's still legendary. And of course, that whole run to the Stanley Cup final. But even beyond that, you know, some tough moments too. Chance that there might not have been a team for a while, and then Joel Schiavone, who used to own the team, ended up sleeping at the top of the Coliseum, and we had an amazing season ticket drive that kept everything alive. I mean, just so many different memories come back and flood in my mind when I think about the Nighthawk days.
And our guest for a bit more grew up listening to WICC back in the day, as they say. He's a Milford native, one-time voice of the New Haven Nighthawks of the American Hockey League, a distinguished college broadcasting career, and now the guy from Milford. He done good. He's going to the Hockey Hall of Fame as this year's winner of the Foster Hewitt Memorial Award. We continue with Dan Ruzanowski. You know, Dan, any of us that have done any level of play-by-play, local cable, local radio, high school stuff, college stuff, D1 hockey, we always wonder what it's like when any of us, any of our broadcast brothers or sisters get that opportunity and get that call and they're told, hey, we want you to be our guy or gal. You've made one of the four major pro sports leagues. What was that like for you?
Well, thrill of a lifetime, you know, something that you work for all your life. It's why we do this. You know, as you know, we do this for the love of the sport and for the challenge of painting the picture for the audience, which I think is not lost on anybody when it comes to radio play-by-play, certainly. And it was a great chance also to start out with a team that had no history, to be part of that from the ground floor, which I thought was really, really special. And of course, I moved to San Jose to make it my home. And it's been very fortunate to say that it has become my home over these decades, and just a great group of fans out here, a wonderful place to live, and a great hockey city now. And it's a lot of the work that was done in those early years, first 2 years at the Cal Palace in San Francisco, followed by what's now called SAP Center at San Jose, which is in downtown San Jose. And, you know, back when I was first starting, people would, you know, say San Jose near San Diego. They wouldn't really know where it was. And they didn't realize that it's the third largest city in California. It's bigger than San Francisco, and yet sometimes had overshadowed it. You know, I suppose the Connecticut audience can sort of compare that with the, I guess you could say, friendly rivalry between New Haven and Hartford. Mm-hmm. You know, Hartford and New Haven always kind of dueling it out a little bit. You know, Yale University, and of course, the tradition of professional hockey and the best pizza in the world and Louis Lunch and all that sort of stuff in New Haven compared to the insurance industry and so forth in Hartford and the capital of the state. They're about the same distance apart, San Jose and San Francisco, but the difference is that San Jose is a bigger city. It's the heart of Silicon Valley, which, of course, is the economic engine of the world these days. And they were just looking for something to draw people together and bring people together in downtown San Jose. And so that's something that a sports team can really do, and it's something that the Sharks are very proud to have been able to do. And so that what happened is that people came to support the team simply because they were supporting their city, and then they fell in love with the game. And of course, people in Connecticut understand mm-hmm. that this is a game that's so fantastic, and it grabs a hold of you the first time you see a game. So I'm sure that's not a surprise to anyone.
Speaking of the first time, Dan Rusinowski, do you have any memories of the first time you went up the stairs or you exited the elevator at the Cow Palace and you sat there and, you know, maybe before your first regular season game or preseason game, exhibition game, did you just kind of sit there and soak it in saying, yeah, I made it, or were you terrified or something in between?
Well, certainly there were some butterflies there because the first game that I did was the first game in the history of the San Jose Sharks, the first official game that I did, and that was in Vancouver at the old Pacific Coliseum. Jim Robson, who's a great Hockey Hall of Fame announcer, was very kind to me, and he took me across the catwalk, and he said, you know, Dan Kelly used to hate doing this. He would look down, and he was afraid of heights, but don't worry about it. It's all safe up here. Meanwhile, I'm walking across the catwalk, and it was a wooden catwalk, and you could see there were a couple of knot holes that had fallen out. So you're wondering if you're going to fall through there. But from that point on, it was just very special. I just remember taking a deep breath and saying, you know, you've worked hard to get to this point. This is only the beginning. Let's have some fun with it. And off we went. You know, it's one of those things where you have some of those butterflies a little bit when you're first starting out. But when you put the headsets on, it seems like all of the worries and all of the problems of the world go away. And that's one of the great joys of doing what we do.
You, Dan, put together an incredible streak, thousands of games, only interrupted by your recovery, which was well chronicled after a nasty car accident. But you picked up after that. And man, it's been 30 plus years. How did you find out that you were in contention for the award, that you had won it? Did somebody call you? Did you get a text? How did that happen?
Well, that's an interesting story, too, because the president of the NHL Broadcasters Association is a name that's known in Connecticut for play-by-play. That would be Chuck Caton, mm-hmm. my good friend, who is still the president of the NHL Broadcasters Association, even though he's no longer active on a regular basis doing play-by-play. And he, you know, was with the Carolina Hurricanes through all those years. Still lives in North Carolina, but fans in Connecticut remember him as the voice of the Hartford Whalers before they moved. And I had absolutely no idea, no clue whatsoever. And that's the way it normally is for things like this. And I got a phone call saying, hey, I've got a question for you. It was just a phone message from him and said, I've got a question for you. I need you to answer. And I, can you give me a call back when you get a chance? So I called back and I said, gosh, I haven't heard from Chuck in a while. It was just great to hear from him. And he said, hey, what are you doing in November? And I said, I don't know. We don't have our schedule yet. And he said, well, and then he told me what the decision was. And it really was special to hear that from a friend and colleague like that, that I respect a lot. And it was pretty amazing. And it's been relatively overwhelming ever since.
Wow. Dan, finally, the award itself, a lot of hockey people know this, I'm sure, but just for the perhaps casual fans, explain who Foster Hewitt was and what the origins of the award are.
Well, Foster Hewitt was really the first very prominent play-by-play announcer in the NHL. In fact, he invented the term, he shoots, he scores, because he needed to figure out a way to describe it on radio in Toronto back in the 1920s. And he was active from that point on all the way through the 1972 Team Canada versus Russia series, where he called that moment when Paul Henderson scored that classic goal in Moscow for Team Canada. He had an incredible career. He was a radio station owner. He was on Hockey Night in Canada every single Saturday night for all the years that it was on radio only and then on television. And, you know, by the time it got to the Team Canada-Russia series in 1972, he had already started to slow down his schedule. But a legendary name in the game of hockey, and that's who the award is named for. Those of us who are very fortunate and privileged to get this award are considered media honorees as far as the Hockey Hall of Fame is concerned. That's slightly different than the honored members, which are the players and the coaches and so forth. And the way that that the festivities work is we have a luncheon for the radio television person, the Foster Hewitt Award winner, which I am privileged to be this year. And also Mark Mulvoy this year is going to get the Elmer Ferguson Award at the same luncheon, which is the print media award that the Hockey Hall of Fame presents and through the Professional Hockey Writers Association. So that happens at a very special lunch, and then we get to go to the actual ceremonies for the induction that night. And it is first class all at the Hall of Fame, and I'm really looking forward to that, to celebrating with my family.
Well, Dan, that's great, and great to connect with you again. I think the last time we actually spoke, you and I were in heavy discussions about a rotisserie league trade, I think, if you remember that. So,
I thought I would let you mention that because your record in this was a little bit better than mine. I think I've improved these days with my fantasy baseball team. But we had a lot of arguments in that in the VIP room of the New Haven Coliseum.
Yes.
Over the course of the media members that were involved in making those deals.
Yes. From Milford, Milford native now, three-decade-plus voice of the NHL San Jose Sharks and this year's winner of the Foster Hewitt Memorial Award, Dan Rusinowski. Dan, good to chat with you. And yes, finally, maybe this year when you're at the garden or on the island, I can stop by. Dan, thanks. Be good and we'll talk.
Can't wait to see you. Great talking to you, Paul. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Dan. Appreciate it. Our regular Monday check-in with Terry Cowgill. He writes, you can see his blog and his columns at the Connecticut News Junkie, ctnewsjunkie.com, and also at Substack. A lot of folks going to Substack. I was thinking of doing a Substack column, but then again, I'd have to actually come up with fresh thoughts every couple of days, which for me might be a little difficult. Mr. Cowgill, good evening, sir. How are you?
Hey, good evening to you, Paul. I think you do just fine with a Substack column because your mind is always filled with new ideas, because you know what? You never run out of material in this business.
That's right. All we do, you know, people say, where do you get your ideas to talk about, right? And Terry, you probably get this. And I'm like, well, I drive around. I see things, right? How do you not want to write about stuff, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And
the way things are going in this state, you know, you there's a lot of material. There really is. Yeah.
Well, here in the great sovereign holy state of Connecticut, Mr. Cowgill, I guess we now are finally going to give folks a little bit more leeway if they encounter a bear. What's up with that?
Yeah, well, you know, it's not everything. It's sort of half a loaf, I think, for people like me who want an actual limited bear hunting season. But they did pass, the General Assembly, I believe was last week, they passed legislation by an overwhelming margin, that bans the feeding of bears. Okay, that's pretty much a no-brainer, because that's one of the reasons the bears are around humans now. And it basically allows residents to use deadly force if self-defense is justified, and so if a bear is attacking you, obviously you can use deadly force. But also, if they are attacking farms, people, pets, livestock, things like that. So I think this is a step in the right direction. All it does is empowers people basically to protect themselves and to protect their property. The problem with the bear population isn't really addressed here. And I have all these people that are telling me, you know, why are you for the, you know, hunting? We moved into their habitat, you know, and that's why they're coming at us. And I don't know. I mean, I've lived around here for 30 years and bears didn't used to be a problem. I just think they're being habituated now and they associate us with food. So they're not, certainly not afraid of us anymore. I know that from personal experience.
Yeah, and the thing that makes me crazy, Terry, literally, I mean, I lose my mind about it on this show, is it's not like the idea of a limited hunt is from some gun nuts. I mean, you have the scientists at DEEP who are on the state payroll and say, hey, it's getting to the point now where numbers-wise and genetically how these bears feel, it's not like you said, Terry, 10, 15, or 20 years ago like it was.
Yeah, and there's no, they don't have any natural predators, you know, and I did actually speak with some of these folks from DEP because, you know, they sent a crew out here to put up one of those barrel traps. And I spoke with them about it. And yeah, they're pretty clear in their views and that, you know, the department is for a limited hunting season because they think it would be a good thing in the long run. But so many people disagree on it here. I mean, they do it in Massachusetts. They do it in New York State. And so it's not like this is some crazy sort of right-wing thing, you know, that they only do in red states. These are progressive states, and yet they're doing it. So I don't know. Go figure. I haven't been able to figure out our legislature in 30 years, and I don't think I'm going to start now.
Yeah. And first thing, tell me why they're going to work on a budget at 3 in the morning, but that's just me. Pardon me. Also in your column tomorrow, you want to cite the importance of teaching civics. Amen. Hallelujah.
Oh, yeah. Well, it is interesting. You know, my colleague, Bart Keck, who has been on WICC before,
sure.
I think maybe with, I don't know if with you or with Joe Aguirre.
Both of us, yeah.
Yeah. He's really big on media literacy, and I agree with him completely. And I think, all you know, there are other things also that need to be taught, such as government and civics. And I think that essential for a lot of reasons. But you know, one of the reasons I think that we have such low turnout for elections is the fact that the civic knowledge among the population is fairly low. And I think most of them think that their vote doesn't really matter anyway, and they're not really concerned about that. But civics empowers the individual. It lets people know exactly what it is they're doing when they're participating in the process and how important it is. And how you really can't, you know, if you didn't vote in the last election and you don't like the people who are in there, you don't really have much standing in the way of complaining, do you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No way.
No, you're right. And Terry, you also mentioned to me something that you and I actually commented together on social media, commencement addresses. And every year, Terry, you get one or two or three of these where the speaker feels that they've got to, you know, be edgy here, or the students act like idiots. And Terry, I agree with you. This whole posturing thing at commencement addresses is just, it's so unfortunate, I think, really.
Yeah, and you don't, a lot of times the message is pretty much the same. You know, when they tell you to follow your passion. And yes, I do agree that you should follow your passions. Does that mean that you should follow your passions to whatever it is you want to do for a living? Well, that's great if the odds of making it in that business are good, and as if you can make enough money to support you, and if you want to have a spouse and kids, then that's great. But I mean, for most of us, you know, if you follow your passions, you're probably not going to live very well. So there's this fellow, Scott Galloway, who I think is really a great, very insightful commentator. He's a professor of marketing at NYU, so he's on Michael Smirkanish on Saturday morning.
Yeah.
And he basically said this is a bunch of, well, he used a colorful phrase that I can't say on terrestrial radio.
Oh, okay. You mean on satellite. All right, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. He said, you know, it's basically bovine feces. It's ridiculous because when he was getting his MBA at Berkeley, his mother had cancer. She required expensive treatments. He had $40,000 in debt. And he said to me, "And you're telling me I should follow my passions? No, my job is to get a job that pays a decent wage, and where I will feel useful in some way. And a lot of times, you know, if you're good at something, even if it's not your absolute passion, you can grow to really like it. And as I said in my column, I think one of your goals should be not just to follow your passions, because your passions might not lead you anywhere that you really want to be, but it also has to do with, I think, making a difference in the world, you know, and you can feel really great about yourself and about your legacy if you do that. And I know that certainly at the high school I went to, one of their slogans is we train students to go into adulthood, and they say, lead lives of consequence.
Hmm.
And so if you can lead a life of consequence and feel like you're doing good work and making a difference in this world, I don't think it really matters that much whether you're following your passions, you know? So that, I mean, that was sort of my point in the whole column, was that sometimes there are more important things than passion. And, you know, as Galloway said, and I love this analogy, he said, look, Beyonce followed her passions, and she is a billionaire.
Yeah.
He said the best thing to do is assume that you're no Beyonce. And I think that works fine.
Yeah, especially if you're Italian like my family's, where, you know, you grow up with constant guilt, right? So just grow up and assume everything's going to fail. Just kidding.
Right,
And what's plan B? Terry, thanks once again, folks. His Connecticut News Junkie column tomorrow on the new Bear Law, which most people like, and the importance of teaching civics. And check him out at Substack.com for his thoughts on commencement addresses. Terry, good to speak with you. We'll chat next week. Thank you.
Good to speak to you too, Paul. Bye.
Take care. Terry Cowgill there with a few ideas. And yeah, I mean, it's follow your passion. I mean, some people do that, and they are so determined to do that that they'll not accept failure. It's kind of like when I got in the radio business, and it still is a tough business, but you know, I think part of the reason I've been doing this for as many years as I have and at the places I have is that I'm just, you know, maybe I will have to someday, but I don't take no for an answer. Same thing with my son. I mean, my son works in theater, in theatrical arts, and he's doing really well, partly because he understood in theater what he was really good at and what he was good at, but a lot of other people are good at too. So he went the really good at route, and he's doing okay. Want to talk to this guy and officially welcome him back once again, as Melissa did this morning, to WICC, and just more proof that when you work with somebody in radio once, you usually work with them two or three times in the future. And having chat, man, what a day. I didn't chat with my Hall of Fame hockey buddy Dan Rusinowski for like 30 years. It hasn't been this long with this guy, but it's been a few years, Paul Peorick. Paul, it's Paul. How are you, sir?
Paul, doing very well. And you?
I'm okay, Paul, and great to have you back here. Once a weather guy, always a weather guy, huh?
You know, I guess, but, you know, I'm sure you realize that 45 years ago, I began at this radio station.
Wow.
I did the overnight show from 78 through 86, from midnight to 5. And back then we had records.
that all ran about 2.5-3 minutes, right?
That's right. And I would play Stairway to Heaven if I had to use the restroom.
Man, you know, Paul, people don't realize that. Most people know everything's computer-based now. All of our music is there. And there is, face it, there's a lot of automation in this business, but there is still some great local talent. But, man, Paul, I broke in, you know, at a little station out on the shoreline like 40 years ago. And, yeah, I mean, just physically, Paul, having to do the shift, you literally were exhausted, right, at the end of that
you
shift?
You were. You had no break whatsoever. You know, I remember we had no network news at the beginning of the hour, so it was just one record after another. And Gary Peters was our PD back then, and he said after every record you had to say a few words. So, you know, at match at three and a half minutes.
Man,
amazing,
man.
Yeah.
And then when you got to like 3:30, 4 in the morning, those words came a little tougher, Paul. And then there was the angelic music when the morning show team finally showed up, right?
That's right. They showed up with donuts, which was always good. You needed that at the end of the day, or the end of the night, I should say. You know, the end of the night. But, you know, Melissa and I worked together at News 12 for a number of years,
yep.
So I know her very well. I know her family. She and I lived in Fairfield for a number of years together, so I would see her, you know, down the street and what have you. So we know each other very well, and it is just so great to be back after 45 years.
Yeah.
You know, it's just amazing. It really is.
Now, Paul, and you and I worked together at a radio station. We used your product back 2007, 2008. Now, besides all your weather stuff, Paul, you have a lot of people don't know, because a lot of weather people don't do it full-time. Some do, but you also have a teaching background, right?
I do. In fact, right now I am still doing that, Earth Science and Math, middle school, and love every minute of it. And with the science, Paul, it's all hands-on. We do not use a book. We do experiments every day. We build volcanoes. We erupt them. We launch hot air balloons. We do, you know, the egg drop from the roof.
Oh, yeah.
And that's more memorable than opening a book and reading. It really is. It makes a world of difference, and it gets everybody excited, and that's what you want.
Hey, Paul, contrast the students you have today to the ones you had years and years ago. Are they generally the same? Are kids of that age sponges still? Do they really want to learn stuff and have fun?
They really do. And the bottom line is, you're right, Paul. They want to have fun. They want to learn. And they want you. They want to know that you are invested in them. They want to know that you are interested in what they're doing. And if you do that, it's going to be a richly rewarding year. And, you know, we do that every year. And I can't tell you the number of letters and emails I get saying it was the best year that my son or daughter ever had. So if you make it exciting, make it fun, and you invest in them, it will really show. It'll make a world of difference.
And, Paul, finally, when did you get the weather bug? I mean, you said you started out like a lot of us did, either early morning or overnight, you know, playing records in this business. But when did the weather bug bite you?
You know, that's a great question, because back in the early 80s, believe it or not, I did get a call from Dr. Mel.
Oh, God.
You remember
yeah.
that name,
oh,
Dr.
Yeah.
Mel?
I worked with him, yeah.
What a great man, the late, great Dr. Mel. He had found out, caught wind that I had a weather station at my home, and he wanted to hook it up, rather, to his weather center up at Danbury at Westcon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he said, would you be willing to do that? And I said, how about a step further? I'd love to go up and visit. And I did, and on the spot, he hired me for weekend weather. And I worked for Dr. Mel for about 4 or 5 years. And one day, a news director of News 12 was listening on the radio. He heard me, and Joe Fury, who does the evening weather now at News 8 that you air at 6 o'clock,
yeah.
You know, Joe was leaving, and the news director said, would you like to come in for an audition? And I did, and after 30 seconds, he said, you start Monday, and I was there for nearly 30 years.
Wow. Yeah, you know, Paul, it is and to the testament finally of the of that Westcon Weather Center. I mean, how many people, Paul, have gone through there? They have one of the best programs in the country, right?
You know, no doubt about that. Dr. Mel began the baccalaureate program there way back in the 80s. And now you have Joe, who went through there. I went through there. Gil Simmons at News 8 went through there. You know, and Zach, who's now at News 8 as well, he went through there. So a lot of names have gone through there. Dr. Mel began it from scratch. And I'll never forget when he did, I was there working for him on the weekends as well. And, you know, he built that weather center and that weather program into one of the best in the region. And it remains that way today.
Well, Paul, thank you. It was great to have you back mornings and afternoons here, and I'm pretty sure I can make sure that the boss up front of the big office won't have you coming in here playing 2.5-minute records. overnight anymore and waiting to see Melissa at 3 in the morning when she comes in.
Yeah, she probably wouldn't bring in the donuts. I wouldn't guarantee that.
All right, Paul Pior. Paul, great to chat with you again after a bunch of years, and we'll talk. Thank you, my friend.
Paul, you're welcome. You have a great show. Really enjoy it every day.
Thank you, Paul. Paul Pioric there, our new weather guy, replacing Bill Jackwoman. And again, people say, well, what's up with Bill? Well, Bill's a busy, busy guy. And he's backing away from the weather part of it to take care of his real estate business and his restaurant business as well. John and Jack, hang on. Traffic and weather from that Paul guy coming up on WICC. So I guess it's never going to change. I guess no matter how much or how often you or I discuss this or talk about it with, you know, our guests or former or present legislators or people who are in the know here, I guess our habit of rushing things in this state when we're trying to figure out what to do with billions of dollars, I guess we're going to continue to do this. Like, I don't know, kids who don't want to work their homework or do their homework. I was a big procrastinator when I was a kid, and I was considered one of the smart kids, okay? So I could kind of get away with it, and I knew it. Geez, I don't know, starting from when I was in like the second or third or fourth grade. Were you one of these guys or gals? I was one of the kids who, if I had a book report to do or a paper, I could literally sit down and write it. Now, again, this is years before even I had a typewriter, let alone a computer. But, you know, I was one of those kids who had the ability to sit down the night before the paper was due or the day before the paper was due and get a couple of volumes of my hardbound encyclopedia at home and, you know, take home some of my school books and bang something out that I would easily, if I gave, you know, half an effort to, I'd get a B plus or an A minus. I was fortunate that I was able to do that. But I learned that if I procrastinated, it didn't really matter because in the end, I was smart enough, thank God. I was blessed with a little bit of an intellect, which I still have some remnants of, that, you know, I was able to kind of just get things done. Well, I guess that's how we're doing things here in Connecticut here. Now, you know, the budget deadline is this coming Wednesday night. So here we are, Monday the 5th. So let's see, the 6, 7, carry the 1 plus 2 minus 3 divided by 4. So this coming Wednesday, June 7th, is the budget deadline. Now, again, we're talking about spending, I don't know, $51 billion or something like that, $50.5 billion, $51 billion or something like that. It's a lot of money, right? But I see here in a couple of things that were sent to me, a couple of text messages I got and a couple of emails I got, the General Assembly finally got the budget, I guess, early today. Now, imagine you're sitting there, and I know in the end they're going to pass something, but I try to do this for you so you can understand what's going on, understand how the process works. You have 151 men and women in the State House, and you have 36 women in men and women of the state Senate. So 151 says, so you have 187 lawmakers in some way, shape, or form that are being asked to vote on something. Now, you ready for this? Somebody sent me this breakdown of it. Now, you got this thing late last night or over the weekend or early this morning. Now, the state budget is 832 pages. In fact, you know what? I may post it on our Facebook page if you want to see it. Okay, it's 832 pages. 832 pages. A summary of spending, I don't know, $51 billion in Hartford. So the people we elect, the guys and the gals, doesn't matter whether you're a D or an R, you know, and I know they negotiate the stuff and everything and they have committees and all this, but in the end, they act like children. They all do. Both sides of the aisle do. They act like children, knowing that, hey, that assignment that paper from science class, that book report is due this coming Wednesday. And it's not like somebody sprung this date on them last week. They've known this from moment one. They've known this from moment one. And I give Governor Lamont all kudos possible for keeping the children in his own party away from raising taxes. I understand that the governor is under constant pressure from a lot of the leftist nuts at the Capitol to raise taxes, screw the rich, pillory the rich, raise taxes or whatever. So he has not let them do that. So on that aspect, kudos to Governor Ned Lamont. But lawmakers now, within the last day or so, were given an 832-page budget bill. It's not like an 800-page spy thriller or an 800-page treatise of American history or War and Peace or something like that. You know, these are voluminous bills, like our pal Chris Caruso said on Friday. You know, these legislators, you know, they plop and they get these big piles of bills. And some of them, actually, kudos to them, think they have to actually read all this stuff. But they can't. So get this now. Somebody send this to me. The budget bill is 832 pages. But now let's do the math here. This is the point of this email I got from somebody here. But legislators have only until this coming Wednesday, middle of the week. Now, we're already almost done with Monday. So essentially, they've got another day and a half. And if they started reading this stuff early today, kudos to them. With roughly 284,000 words in the budget, and the average person, I love this, somebody actually broke this down for me, the average person reading at about 130 words a minute, that's the average reading time. 130 words a minute, which is about half of a typewritten page. I know it seems slow, but, you know, to read this stuff, there's got to be a certain amount of comprehension to it. A lawmaker, if they were really had an effort to read what in the hell they're going to vote on, a lawmaker would need 36-plus hours to simply read the entire Connecticut state budget. 36 hours. Or, as this person said when they sent it to me, that would break down to 4 hours short of a 40-hour work week. But yet, and again, I'm not pinning this on left or right or Democrat or Republican, because it's happened with both administrations in Hartford under the Capitol Dome there and in the governor's mansion. But yet, for some reason, some antiquated reason, as our pal Chris Caruso mentioned last Friday, for a reason going back to the time when Connecticut was an agrarian society, as in farmers, as in horses and donkeys and mules pulling non-mechanical farm aids. In the year 2023, for God knows why, we are still relying on an antiquated timetable from probably, when did this go down, who knows, the late 1600s, early 1700s? And we wonder why. Now, we have to wait and see what comes out over the next few days. But we wonder why, in this great state that we hear about, oh, the state's such a high-income state. Well, guess what? Get rid of Fairfield County, and it ain't all that good. But I digress. Such a high-income state with all these incredibly smart people. We always hear from whatever governor is, oh, we're so smart here in Connecticut. We have all these smart people, and we're smart with this, and we're smart with that. Well, apparently not. Because if we were that smart, we would have years ago ask the people of Connecticut, hey, we have to readjust the legislative terms here. Why, Paul? Why would you do that? Because it doesn't make any sense. These are the two or three days when our lawmakers, for some reason, I saw a couple of social media posts this past week from lawmakers literally boasting about the fact that they were setting up, I'm serious about this, and these are relatively intelligent people whom I've spoken to from time to time. But you have lawmakers in Hartford on social media saying, hey, here we go again. And they're putting air mattresses in their offices because they know they won't be home for 3 or 4 days. Hello? Is anybody here? Is this thing on? Am I the only person here who thinks that's absolutely ludicrous? A $51 billion spending package, and we're going to have lawmakers, men and women of both parties, literally, half asleep over the next 2 or 3 days, likely, unless there's some big kumbaya that I don't know about, something angelic from on high, these people, and who I get are all fine people, but they are working under an antiquated system. It is mind-numbing that while you and I are blissfully asleep in our condos or homes or apartments or townhouses, pushing up, doing Z's, like they say at night, nice rollover under the sheets. Ah, this is good. Perfect temperature. The AC's cranking. It's good. We're going to have lawmakers in Hartford literally half asleep trying to, in some way, shape, or form, understand what in the hell they're reading. Now, I know in the end there'll be votes on it and something will get passed. The state's not going to crumble. But I don't know. I'm still trying to hear from somebody who can give me, in the year 2023, a good reason, a sound reason, as to why these budget battles every 2 years or every other year, if you do an adjustment on the odd years, why they come down to this idiocy and this legislative lunacy of making people vote late. Again, to my original point, like we're putting off a book report or a science project. Ma, I don't want to do my paper now, honey. You have to, because if you don't, you're going to flunk, and we won't take our trip to the cabin this year. All right, give me my paper. I mean, it is lunacy. So, by the way, do you run your business like this? If you're out there, let me know. 203-333-9422. 333-WICC. How many of you small or medium or large business people, I may have some CFOs or CEOs out there listening, do you start looking over an 832-page budget document 2 days and change before you have to sign off on it? Do you read consistently for 2 or 3 days in a row and say, hey, I've got this? Or do you do something that normal people do and say, hey, if I know it's due on this date, I'm going to start a month, month and a half out and have the finished product? Oh, but we can't do that. Oh, no.